Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, May 5th, welcome, friends. On Into the Program, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today on Studio 2, it feels like a lot is happening in Philadelphia when it comes to politics and at City Hall. All of it happening at once. There's a school board vote to close 17 schools. There's the Uber and Lyft tax. There's a bus terminal that just reopened. And of course, that heated third congressional district race. And so we brought in some very smart reporters today to do a roundup of sorts to help us parse through what happened, what matters, and what we can expect coming up next. And so we have Philadelphia Inquirer education reporter Kristen Graham. We have Inquirer City Hall reporter Anna Orso. And of course, WHYY's own Tom McDonald.
T-Mac.
So, yeah, T-Mac is in the house today. And so we have a sharp group of folks. And we want to, of course, hear from you. What Philadelphia news stories are you paying closest attention to? We'd love to get your thoughts. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is Studio2@WHYY.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can drop your comments in the chat. And we're just talking Philly today, but there's probably stuff happening. There's stuff happening all over the region, but today we're going to zoom in on Philly.
There's always stuff.
There's stuff.
Lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Capital S stuff. We're asking you, what Philly news story are you paying closest attention to? Again, 888-477-9499, the email studio2@WHYY.org. And on top of all that, we're still doing our trio of local news headlines, starting across the river in Camden, where 100 school district employees started to receive layoff notices last week. The Inquirer reports that this round of layoffs includes the district's entire central office staff. This is part of a broader restructuring that will take effect on July 1st. Some of these laid-off employees could be eligible for new jobs, but regardless, this is a major shakeup at the school district over in Camden. And this comes after an even bigger round of layoffs last year when the district faced a $90 million budget deficit. Big picture here, Camden's traditional public school district has shrunk dramatically in recent years as more and more students attend charter schools or former public schools run by charter organizations. And these layoffs are downstream of all of that.
Yeah. Shout out to Melanie Burney on this story. I remember reading about the school takeover back in 2013. And according to the reporting here, enrollment has dropped nearly 50%. While the funding to the actual district has gone up, a majority of that money goes to the charter schools and the Renaissance schools that have become the alternative to traditional public schools. So, Avi, I put myself in a place of a parent who is in the traditional schools, and you see, oh my goodness, there's more faculty members leaving, more staff leaving because of layoffs, and you wonder whether or not you should keep your kid there, or maybe you should also pivot to the charter schools or the Renaissance schools. And it's like this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Like when you downsize and you downsize, the people who are left are wondering whether they need to leave as well because there's just less resources.
Yeah, a similar dynamic is at play in the story we'll discuss later about the school district of Philadelphia. So it's not just happening in Camden, New Jersey.
No.
It's happening. It's been happening. Really, this is a decades-long story at this point. It's been happening in major cities all over the country.
Yeah. Story number two, Penn researchers are using artificial intelligence to mine social media threads in order to get more information on common side effects of certain drugs. A shout out to Inquirer's Kayla Yup on this story about University of Pennsylvania scientists' use of AI to go through more than 400,000, yes, 400,000 Reddit posts about GLP-1 drugs to analyze self-reported side effects. And if you didn't know, there are some very popular Reddit threads where people openly and for the most part, possibly honestly, discuss what they're dealing with while using Wegovy and other GLP-1s. And these Penn scientists published their findings in the journal Nature Health, arguing that AI can be used to help gather large-scale data on longer-term use of certain drugs and treatments. And according to the Inquirer, this model is being tested on a wide range of treatments, but there are limitations. For example, Reddit kind of skews very American, male, young and well-educated. So the post that they're mining may not be representative of all GLP-1 users. Plus, you have to take into a possibility that people are lying or may not be experiencing the side effects that they mention. But the bottom line is AI can help researchers gather information over time about drugs and treatments, since most clinical research trials are short and very expensive.
I think that's the key point, right? I don't think anyone's going to say mining social media for user posts and experience is going to replace like a standard clinical trial where you have controls and you follow up with people in a very precise way. But what it can do is A, gather information over a longer period of time, B, look for like smaller proportion side effects, because if you're talking about 400,000 Reddit posts and there is a side effect that maybe impacts a very small number of people that wouldn't be caught in a standard clinical trial, you can follow up on that. And that's what this story, which I found very interesting, made me think of. It feels like this type of data mining could be a guide for like what should we study in a standard clinical trial down the road. Oh, this type of side effect is popping up. We hadn't really thought about that. What might be the cause of that? Let's look a little deeper. Like, I don't think anyone's going to make any solid conclusions based on, you know, mining Reddit posts, but it could be like a guide for scientists in the future. And so I did think this was a really interesting way to approach scientific research, and it feels like it would have broad implications beyond just this one class of drug.
Absolutely. I mean, the FDA has currently just relies on its own reporting system. But like you said, a lot of people don't, they don't report anything to these government agencies, and they're only getting it if you're honest with your doctor, because a lot of people are not 100% honest there either. And so they've already been piloting the use of AI and searching and scraping online to find some of the seasonal swings when it comes to COVID, right?
You know what that reminds me of, actually? Yeah. And I don't think this was ever scientifically proven, but when sort of COVID was at its peak, one thing people speculated is that you could tell when a COVID wave was about to hit, because lots of people would be going on, like, they'd be going to user review pages for Yankee candles and saying, why doesn't this smell like anything? This is a broken candle. And when those complaints went up, because COVID affects your sense
your
of smell.
Sense of smell,
so that's like, and again, I don't know if that was true, but it's the same idea, right? Is that when lots of people are reporting something and you can sort of systematically try to trawl for it, you might be able to pick up on trends that would be very difficult to pick up on otherwise.
And I'd say go for it, FDA. I mean, use every tool in the toolbox to help narrow down what people are dealing with when it comes to these drugs and treatments. Third story today.
Caffeine's a drug.
Yeah.
In a sense. Do you drink energy drinks?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. You used to.
I used to, yeah.
What was your vice there? What was your weapon of choice?
Red Bull.
Was it really Red Bull?
Yeah, but the crash was too crazy.
Wait, so when were you a Red Bull drinker?
For years, during my law days, It helped me get through late nights and, it helped my mind be clear.
I can't stand the taste of Red Bull.
Really?
Yeah, I find it.
Add some vodka.
We digress kind of. So there's a recently introduced bill in Delaware that would ban the sale of energy drinks to minors. If passed, minors could still possess and consume energy drinks, but stores would not be allowed to sell these drinks to people under 18. So I guess if you ask for a Red Bull at the 7-Eleven, if this law were ever to pass, they would ID you. In this case, energy drink is defined as a beverage that contains 100 or more milligrams of caffeine per 8 fluid ounces, which is roughly equivalent to a cup of coffee. However, this particular bill would not apply to drinks like coffee and tea. So a toddler could still walk into a Starbucks and, I guess, get a coffee. But it would just apply to energy drinks that are advertised as energy drinks. Again, this bill is not passed, but I had never heard even of this idea. Did a little research. It's popped up before as a proposal in some other states, but I'm not aware of a state that's actually passed a law like this. So maybe something to keep an eye on. People are worried about the effects of these energy drinks on kids.
Yeah. And by the way, several countries Lithuania is one. Poland is another one, has already restricted sales.
Yeah. Eastern Europe, for some reason.
They've already done that. But I think part of the issue is the American Academy of Pediatrics, they've advised against caffeine at all for kids under 12, and they only want very limited amounts for kids 12 to 18 because it can cause some serious problems. Long after the energy drink has left your system, they talk about sleep deprivation, anxiety, depression, even seizures. So it could have some serious side effects for kids. And the kids probably don't even know that.
Yeah. I wonder how prevalent it is among young people.
Yeah.
Maybe pretty. I don't know how. I mean, I haven't been in high school in a long time. Energy drinks were just not as big a deal when I was in high school.
Not for me either.
But maybe they're more prevalent now.
Yeah, I've had some heart palpitations. I left that stuff alone. I just drank straight coffee now.
Straight coffee. The OG energy drink.
OG energy.
We're going to be bringing the energy to a conversation about local news coming up on Studio 2. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. Studio 2 at WHYY.org.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today on the show, it's a local news roundup. And to kick things off, we're starting with an issue that came to a head with a contentious vote last week by Philadelphia's school board.
Yeah, as part of a larger facilities master plan to upgrade city schools, the board voted to close 17 schools. Several city council members vociferously opposed the move and tried to pressure the board to oppose it. Councilmember Isaiah Thomas said he was close to tears about the decision. Here's what it sounded like at a district headquarters ahead of the 6-3 vote. Take a listen.
We want help. We're not heard.
We want help.
We're not heard. You want help.
We're not heard.
You want help.
You won't vote if we're not heard, but they did vote. The decision came after an analysis of enrollment patterns. Superintendent Tony Watlington says the change is needed to ensure the remaining schools have what they need to thrive. Here to help us study up on the fallout is Philadelphia Inquirer education reporter Kristen Graham. Kristen, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thank you, Avi. Thank you, Cherry.
So great to have you. And if you're listening at home on the road or elsewhere, you have thoughts on the school closures or any other major city headlines, we would love to hear from you. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can drop a comment in the chat.
Nichelle says the whole board and the superintendent need to be fired. Lots of people fired up about this decision. Kristen, first, a little background. Why did the school district feel it had to pass this plan to close 17 schools? And we should note, revamp many, many more.
Right. So district-wide, there are about 70,000 empty seats spread across the city. And in some places, there are schools that are overcrowded and some places that are schools that have 1,000 or more extra seats that aren't being filled by students. And, you know, also districts' buildings are incredibly old, lots of environmental problems in some of them, asbestos, mold, lead. You know, we've seen some temporary closures because of those issues. And also academics aren't where they should be. And so basically the district said, you know, we can't keep kicking this can down the road, the superintendent and school board president have said, and they decided to embark on a facilities master plan. So looking at, you know, where we might need to build, where we might need to close schools or combine schools.
Yeah. And we had Superintendent Watlington on a couple months ago where he laid out this plan. People were very upset, but there was some movement, there was some change and some negotiation on this plan. Can you lay out to where they started and to what the plan is now that it was voted on by the board?
Sure. So initially when Dr. Watlington proposed the plan, there were 20 school closures and 159 schools were being renovated. And so I think when we talk about this plan, we do often call it a school closure plan, right? But that is, you know, kind of by the numbers, that's the smallest part, right? Of course, because it has the biggest impact, you know, it's a enormously emotional thing to close schools, but that was negotiated down after communities fought back and certainly politicians got down. Initially, it was 18 school closures and 17, and they bumped it up to 169 schools being renovated. But there's a big question mark, right? So initially, the price tag was $2.8 billion, billion with a B. The district is only paying for $1 billion of that through its regular capital borrowing. The rest is kind of a question mark because they are counting on either the state to come through with new money or philanthropic sources to come through with new money. And we know that's not a given.
Yeah. And speaking of the state, we've talked a lot about the reaction here in the city. Lots of local politicians in Philadelphia are upset about this plan. How do state leaders view it? Because people should note that the school district gets a lot of its funding from the state. The folks in Harrisburg have a lot of power over the finances of the school district. How are they viewing this move by the district?
Absolutely. So as you said, Avi, it's really important to note Philly is unique in Pennsylvania, the only district that cannot raise its own revenue. We don't have an elected school board. And so we really are, as a school system, kind of beholden to both the city and the state for about 50% each of funding. And so while, you know, the city feels some kind of way about closing schools, at the state, you have a lot of, you know, Republican lawmakers who say, we're not going to give Philly an extra dime if you don't right size, right? Like, you have 70,000 extra seats. What are you doing with that? So, you know, certainly we've seen a lot of pressure locally to not close schools, but we know at the state, you know, for Philly to be seen in a way that they continue to get more money, you know, this was something that, you know, the district felt that it had to do, that district leaders felt they had to do.
Yeah. So the city council came out strong. There were protests. Folks were very loud. Thank you for laboring to be there at those meetings for all of us here. So what are the next steps at this point? Because it seems like the board voted 6-3. It's pushing forward. When could we start to see things going into action?
So one important thing to note is that nothing happens with this plan until 2027. By design, there's a planning year. And also, while the school board took a vote, it was a vote to start a process. So in order to close a school, there's a very specific set of, you know, you have to have a hearing, you have to read this legal language. No school is closed until those secondary hearings happen. But, you know, what happens immediately is these communities have to plan, and, you know, teachers, parents, kids in affected schools, you know, the district is saying you will have a say in what it looks like when, you know, you're in school X, you move to school Y, or, you know, when schools grow a grade, what that might look like, how a school that's now an elementary school might look when it gets middle grades. But also kind of on the city and district side, you know, we've got this big rift, right? Like, I have never in my years of reporting seen city council members stand at a board meeting. They were getting as close to the board as they could and shouting and trying to disrupt the process.
Let's talk about the consequences of that rift potentially, right? So what could or what has council threatened to do in retaliation for this vote?
So basically, various city council members, led by council member Isaiah Thomas, led by council member Jamie Gauthier, have said, you know, we are not going to vote for the Uber tax, which is $1 per ride, which would go to fund the district shortfall. They've said up to and including they're not going to vote for school board members' reelection. Board members come up again when if Mayor Parker is reelected, she reappoints them, but city council has to vote
on
their appointment.
Them.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that could happen. They have called on several council members have called on the board members who voted for the school closings to resign. So, you know, there's a lot out there.
Before we wrap up, I do think it's important to explain to people why the district is in the financial situation that it's in, where it seems like expenses are rising faster than revenues, and they have these, you know, financial pressures acting upon them. I know it's a lot to get through, but in like 30 seconds, could you explain how the district is in this situation at all?
So structural deficit, right? Because the district does not control its own financial, you know, its revenues. Because salaries are growing, revenues are growing, payments to charter schools are growing, you know, they basically have a finite pool of resources to draw from, and that's controlled by the city and state. It's not like they can go out and say, hey, we're going to raise taxes. The school board can't do that. So it's really, you know, that is a unique creation.
Yeah. And last question, and Avi has raised this point in the past as we wrap up. I mean, has city council offered to provide more money? Because if you don't want to close schools, somehow you need more money to keep the other ones open?
So, yes, but the current proposal that's afoot is for this Uber tax, which would not go for buildings, right? Like, these are two different things. There's, you know, the capital budget, which is keeping schools open, fixing buildings. And then on the other side, there's the operational budget, and the Uber tax that's on offer, which would be about $50 million, would go to stave off some staff cuts.
And that teases up for
Our next segment. Before we get you out of here, we wanted to ask each of our panelists today for a local story that you can't stop thinking about. Maybe, I don't know if it's on the fun side, I don't know if it's on the quirky side. What's on your mind right now, Kristen Graham?
I think it's kind of fun and quirky. So a couple weeks ago, my colleague Alex Coffey did this fantastic story about Deb Willig, who is longtime. I know her because she's a longtime
labor attorney, right?
PFT. Did you know she also is responsible for the WNBA's record-breaking new collective bargaining agreement? They got something like a 300% pay increase.
She helps negotiate for the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and the WNBA?
She absolutely. And the WNBA folks were like, this lady knows what she's talking about. Like, she is fearless. And Alex Coffey did a lovely profile of her. And Deb, by the way, is a former high school athlete, a basketball player at Lower Merion, and she was like, our facilities were terrible then, we need better for women athletes. So
she needs to be on the negotiation team for those facilities. It sounds like she gets it done.
it was a great story, and definitely worth the read.
Absolutely. Well, shout out to Alex Coffey, who's a great journalist with the sports section of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Wonderful.
And Kristen Graham, who is a great education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer as well. Kristen, we so appreciate your time on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
All right. Coming up next, we'll be talking about that Uber tax on the other side of this break. And we'd love to hear from you. What Philadelphia stories are you paying most attention to right now? The number to call is 888-477-9499. That email is studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Supporting WHYY Laurel Hill, dedicated to serving families for more than 185 years with traditional and green burials, cremations, and life celebrations. The gift of pre-planning is a true act of kindness. The caring team at Laurel Hill can help create customized arrangements that meet your personal needs. Laurel Hill proudly serves all funeral homes, and their funeral home proudly serves all cemeteries. You can learn more at laurelhillphl.com.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're doing a local news roundup this hour. And now we're going to follow up on the topic of education and Mayor Sherrill Parker's plan to contend with the $300 million deficit that is facing Philadelphia schools.
Parker is pushing for a $1 per ride tax on Uber and Lyft. She says the tax will funnel $48 million a year towards schools and stave off cuts to teachers and counselors. The ride-hailing industry is going on the offensive, though. Here's an attack ad Uber released against Parker.
Mayor Sherrill Parker has proposed a double tax on rideshare, adding an additional $1 fee to all trips in Philadelphia, which will be passed on directly to riders. When Philadelphians are already stretched thin, the mayor is proposing to make rides less affordable. Real riders will be affected, like seniors on fixed incomes and riders with disabilities. Tell the mayor that working people can't afford another city tax. Tell the city council, vote no on the new rideshare tax.
Yeah, there you heard it. And with us to help us unpack this ride share tax plus other local headlines, we have Anna Orso, a reporter covering City Hall for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Anna, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And of course, we have the one and only Tom McDonald, a.k.a. T-Mac here, reporter for WHYY, covers all things Philadelphia. And thank you so much for being back on the show. Yeah. And our question for you, our listeners, what Philadelphia news stories are you paying closest attention to? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube and Facebook, share this video, but also drop a comment in the chat.
I'll read a couple here. Melinda on Facebook just says Philly feels chaotic right now.
Yeah.
So I guess Melinda's concerned about everything. Harold wants us to tax Comcast and the U of Penn and get rid of the tax abatement. And Ruth from Chester County says a single dollar per ride to help the Philly schools is a bargain. Look at the positive. So let's look at the positive and the negative, mm-hmm. Anna. The evolution of this proposal was seemed unusual to me because it was supposed to be a lower tax, then it became a bigger tax. Take us through the timeline here of how this Uber and Lyft tax came to be.
Yeah, it was kind of a bizarre timeline. So when the mayor unveiled her budget proposal in early March, she proposed a 20-cent per ride tax.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a few weeks, the mayor came out and amended that. And she said, actually, it's going to be $1 per ride. You know, that's a big difference for people who use Uber and Lyft a lot. The mayor said that to her administration, it wasn't entirely clear, you know, how the district was going to deal with this structural deficit that they had. And once the mayor heard that the district was planning to cut some 340 jobs, they said, oh, we need to do more.
Yeah. Mm. And so tell us about, you know, her goals for this and then some of the pushback that you've been seeing and hearing.
Yeah. So from the mayor's perspective, she thinks this is a reasonable tax to levy. Dozens of other jurisdictions across the country, including New York City, you know, our friends to the north, levy taxes on Uber and Lyft. And so she sees this as a reasonable idea. Obviously, Uber disagrees. Uber is really used to getting involved in these sorts of regulatory battles. They do it across the country, and they've deployed an army of lobbyists and PR officials to come to City Hall and try to kill it.
And Uber is being way more aggressive than Lyft here, right? Like, Lyft's against it. Like, their position is we do not favor the tax, right? But I haven't seen much from Lyft. And Uber, like, every time you open the app, they're pinging you or telling you to contact someone about it. Is that the kind of state of play here, Anna?
Absolutely. Uber is being really forceful and aggressive, and this has kind of always been their approach. As far as I know, Lyft has sent one letter to the mayor's administration expressing their concerns.
They're like, going to handle it. Yeah.
Expressing their concerns, but maybe from their perspective, they're like, hey, our big brother's got this under control.
Hmm. So interesting. Tom, I wanted to bring you in the conversation because I wanted to zoom out a bit. Every mayor seems to have a tax. You know, you think about Kenny with the soda tax. Nutter had the cigarette tax. How does this sort of stack up? In your prediction, have we seen the worst of the fight yet?
Well, first of all, there's one common thread here. Rob Dubow, who is the man who runs the whole operation for finances in the city. He comes up with these new additional levies. They won't call them a tax. We call them a tax because it looks good. Rob calls it an additional levy, anything you want to go with. But this is nothing more than the same thing as you said. We had the cigarette tax. We had the soda tax. I mean, Anna will remember John Street walking around during the Kenny administration with his 2-liter bottle, his empty 2-liter mm-hmm. bottle, saying, this is ridiculous. I mean, a former mayor complaining against a previous mayor. It's something that Rob has always come up with to close the gap.
Little holes that
right.
develop
and
across the budget.
When you look at it, there's an alternative. You don't have to pay this tax. And it's the same thing with cigarettes. It's the same thing with soda.
Yeah, you don't have to buy it.
You
yeah.
don't have to buy it. So you can go on SEPTA.
And then you don't have
you don't have to pay the tax.
Yeah.
So that's something that it's almost a sin tax.
Yeah. What's mm-hmm. the reaction been on council for this tax compared to some of those other? Is there more pushback here, less pushback? What's your sense of how council has reacted here, Tom?
Well, it's because there are so many lobbyists on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Uber's spending a lot of money. They spent a lot of money. The soda people spent a lot of money on soda. It dwarfs what the Uber people are spending this time around.
Yeah.
They don't want this surcharge to gain a foothold and be just dominoes across the country.
Right,
every
right.
major
other
city.
Cities, other cities take a page out of the book.
Right, yeah. And that's why there is so much lobbying going on here.
Let me ask you, Anna, though, like, if mm-hmm. I'm a city council member, why am I scared of Uber? Like, are they really in this for the long haul? Are they going to finance my opponent in the next election?
Yeah.
Or are they just going to move on to the next city whenever this budget is done? Like, do you think that people on council really are scared of what Uber could do to them here?
I think it's certainly possible. What I think is more likely is that they might think that Uber has a compelling argument. Uber is presenting a lot of data. And look, you can make numbers say whatever you want them to.
Yeah.
But Uber's got a lot of data that says that lower income people rely on rideshare, maybe more than you might think or might be intuitive. And so I think a lot of council members are kind of thinking about that and like, what impact is this really going to have on, you know, folks who don't have a couple
of constituents will really feel this. Yeah.
Exactly.
And before we transition to the next story, and which I think could be a good transition point, have you heard or have we seen large-scale pushback from people, from regular constituents, or is this just a political battle at this point?
I mean, I think it probably feels like mostly a political battle at this point. But I mean, look, there are a lot of people who are seeing that message in the Uber app every time they use it that says, like, do you want this to be more expensive? Most people would prefer it not be.
Yeah. And transitioning now to the Safe Healthy Homes Act, a bill that was not just political. It got really loud where you saw very large and loud protests from people who are renters and people who are, you know, landlords. Can you tell us what the Safe Healthy Homes Act is and sort of like who's on either side for folks who haven't been paying attention?
Yeah, so this is a package of bills that would essentially provide new protections for renters. Renters make up about half of the people in the city. And so what this would do is, protect them from landlords who maybe take too long to respond to safety concerns, don't take care of code violations. It would like allow you to not have to pay your rent if your landlord doesn't fix what's considered an unsafe home. There were advocates have been working on this issue for, gosh, years. There are people who are sort of aligned with the tenants and renters rights groups who have been very active on this side. On the other side are, groups, especially one called HAPCO, which represents landlords from across the city. And they lobbied hard against this legislation, so hard that they filed a lawsuit over it even before it even passed.
Mm. Yeah.
And what's the status of that? Because my understanding is that eventually the package passed council, right? Do we have that right, Anna?
That's correct.
So are the landlords still suing? Are they still trying to stop this? Where does the legislation sit right now?
Yeah, so right now the legislation is passed. We are awaiting another hearing. So the landlord sued saying that city council violated the Sunshine Act, which is kind of a novel way to stop a piece of legislation with. Basically, they said the council didn't follow.
It was a procedural flaw.
It was a procedural flaw, yeah. Exactly. They took the city to court over it. A federal judge basically said last month, the city can go ahead and take the vote, but we're going to hold a hearing about this in June. Mm. Yeah. So we'll see.
And Tom, wanted to bring you into the conversation because I know a lot of landlords have pushed back on this in large part because they said, look, a lot of the city organizations, the city like L&I, all the different agencies, they have a lot of backlog. It's slow. And this would put landlords at a disadvantage. Your thoughts on that?
You've got to look at the smallest of landlords. If you own a duplex, you are officially a landlord. Some people can't afford all the extra steps that it takes to certify that second floor room, that second floor apartment. And that is going to hurt people to the point where they're going to have to sell. That will open it up for the bigger landlords to buy up properties that they wouldn't normally get. And it's a way for people to be able to, we talk about affordability gap in housing in Philadelphia. It closes that affordability gap even more because there are people who can afford to buy a duplex but couldn't afford to buy a single family home, and those people wouldn't get homes.
And where's Parker on all this? Where's the mayor? What's the mayor saying about this legislative package? You just gave a shrug, Tom.
It's not a priority right now. I mean, the number one priority is the Uber.
Yeah. Speaking of where does the mayor stand, let's talk about the ICE out legislation package, because this has been a real cat and mouse game politically. First, let's talk about what's in the package, Anna. So this is anti-ICE legislation that was the proposed and passed by city council. What's in it?
Well, there's seven bills. They do all sorts of things. The most important ones would basically make – Philadelphia sanctuary status a law, so a new mayor couldn't come in and revoke it. It's currently in practice because of an executive order. It would also prohibit ICE from carrying out raids on city-owned properties, rec centers, libraries, things like that. And it would ban ICE officers from wearing masks or otherwise concealing their identities inside the city.
Yeah. And what has been the Parker administration? Because I know there's been a lot of support from the public. There's been a lot of support from city council. Ru Landau has been one of the leaders of this. But what has been the Parker administration's response, given the fact that the mayor has been very tepid when it comes to flouting our sanctuary city status here in Philadelphia?
Absolutely. The mayor has said very little about this. She's basically said, look, we know this is an issue that a lot of people care about, and I'm going to think about it closely. As you said, the mayor has, you know, as you said, the mayor has really like avoided criticizing the Trump administration. And so that
and,
will go
and jump in.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt, but the one thing that the mayor does repeatedly say is Philadelphia is not technically a sanctuary city.
She says welcoming.
Welcoming city. And I will tell the story, and I think Anna was there, of a reporter from a television station that tried to confront the mayor on that and got a 15-minute lecture. And I'm not kidding when people say 15 minutes. I timed it. It was a 15-minute dressing down during a mayor's press conference.
Wow.
Because they do not want that S word attached to Philadelphia.
And I want to do a quick follow up for you about this, because we've seen the Trump administration be very aggressive. They sued New Jersey on multiple fronts. Is the mayor worried about the lawsuits and then having to battle the Trump administration in court, Anna?
Yeah, I think they're worried about a couple of things. I think they're worried about lawsuits. I think that they do not want the Trump administration sending a surge of ICE officers here to the city like they did in Minneapolis or in Chicago or other cities that maybe got on the president's bad side a little bit. I also think that the mayor knows that Philadelphia really, really relies on federal funding for so much. I mean, many, many, many millions of dollars a year. And she doesn't want to put that more at risk than it already is.
But to be clear, nothing yet from the feds. Like, we haven't seen any concrete retaliation action, Tom, from the feds. Maybe they're watching.
Because the city continues to stress that it is not a sanctuary city. As long as the city doesn't call itself a sanctuary city, it will continue to fly under the radar. Yeah.
Now, let's get to the story that Larry is thinking about right now. Larry says he's thinking about the ugliness in the 3rd congressional district race. All three major candidates have their pluses and minuses. But from what some of their supporters are saying, I'd expect this country to implode if the other candidate is elected to Congress. Thanks for that comment, Larry. So let's talk about the 3rd congressional race first. Let's get everyone up to speed, Tom. Who are the big three in the race? And this is a district that covers basically West Philadelphia, Northwest Philadelphia, a little bit of South Philly as well. But it's a lot of Philadelphia in this 3rd congressional district. Who's in it?
You've got two established politicians. Okay, the leader of that is Sharif Street. And the true opponent here is Dr. Ayla Stanford. And she's on every source of media over and over and over again. I don't think you can go near any source of media. She's backed by a scientist pack that is using what is called dark money in order to control the media in this election. I mean, somebody told me they saw a Sharif Street ad, but like I haven't seen it personally.
Yeah.
And you're
just Sharif Street's a state senator. He's the son of a former mayor, John Street, a nephew of former state senator, Milton Street. So he's been around for
former
a long
time.
Former
head of the Pennsylvania Democratic Political Party.
Ayla Stanford is doctor.
During COVID, she became a poster child for making sure that everyone got a vaccine, everyone got treated.
And then Chris Rabb, who's a state rep in Northwest Philadelphia, has kind of carved out the progressive lane in this race. So those are the big three. I mean, what do you say, Anna, what do you think is kind of like the big sort of the big headlines in over the last few weeks of this race? Because we're kind of getting into the season where the normies are starting to pay attention.
Popping their heads out like us.
What have been some of the big headlines that have popped up recently?
Yeah, well, I've been paying attention for a while because I'm a sicko. and I agree with Larry that it's gotten kind of messy lately. So, I mean, look, a lot of this comes down to style. They're all Democrats. They're running in a Democratic primary. They really agree on a lot more than they disagree on. They all, like, want to abolish ICE. They all believe in Medicare for all. a lot of this comes down to how do you approach the job? You know, Sharif Street is, like Tom was saying, he's sort of your establishment politician. As some might say, he you know, might tinker around the edges to try to fix things in ways that you can do by building compromise and building coalitions.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But Sharif is not like his father and uncle.
True.
He's more of a quiet power behind the scenes.
Very strategic.
And that makes a big difference.
Right, because John Street and Milton Street had more of a reputation, at least earlier in the career,
well,
of kind of being insurgent
candidates.
They both
started as street vendors become activists.
Yeah.
And Sharif's not that way. I mean, Sharif has lived his life through politics, has learned how to quietly broker deals. And he's not that screaming person leaning against a casket that Milton was.
Mm. Yeah.
And his father was a lot more in the middle. And I think Sharif is just so subdued. And the one thing we have to look at in this election, it's going to be a low turnout election.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to see a lot of people. Those elections in Philadelphia are controlled by the ward leaders. The ward leaders are, for the most part, backing Senator Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to talk about flaws a little bit and what voters are saying, because last week we had our political debate, third district debate. Dr. Ayla Sanford chose not to come, citing a number of issues. But I want to, was that a mistake? Was that, does it matter given the fact that she has millions of dollars? And I think one morning and within an hour and a half, I saw seven Ayla Sanford commercials. I mean, does it matter at this point? Is it really about the TV game? Do whether or not you have another debate, does that even matter at this point? Because people already made up their minds, Anna?
Personally, I think it does matter. With races like this, there are always a lot of undecideds. And as Tom said, it's a relatively low turnout race, which means it's high information. People are really paying attention. People are, you know, close to the party. They're wondering what's going on. I do think that people notice when things happen with, you know, Ayla Sanford having sort of a rough week and then skipping a debate. But what I will say is, like, advertising matters so much, and we're not talking about like a little gap. We're talking about an enormous gap. This super PAC backing her has spent more than $3 million on ads. Sharif Street's campaign has spent less than $100,000.
Yeah.
And Chris Rabb,
I haven't seen any Rabb commercials at all.
Real quick, strengths and weaknesses for Rabb's candidacy, because we kind of got the strengths and weaknesses for the other two.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rabb is kind of like your progressive insurgent, like a really good speaker, has that stage presence. He says he'd be part of the squad. And so, you know, I think his hope is that the other two candidates kind of split the centrist vote and he can sort of scoot up the left lane and win.
But he's got no grassroots support.
He's got no
door knockers.
He has a lot of online support, though.
I understand that. But getting people to get out of their house and get to the voting booth is the key here.
Right.
Without the door knockers, you don't have a race.
I will say, push back a little bit, because if you go to the Northwest, those people up there, I mean, they are all, they
and
love
it's a very progressive
Chris
area.
Rabb. Yes.
It's a very progressive
and
area.
And they will swat you if you say anything bad about this man.
It's not the point. The point is, will they get out and go to the polls? And that's the key in a low turnout election.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of Democrats coming out because they want to defeat the current incumbent in Washington. But this race, whoever the Democrat is going to win.
Yeah. By the way, since we're talking politics, a big host committee, folks came to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is in the running, Tom, to host the DNC in 2028. What happened? By the way, we were hosts in 2016.
Right.
A lot of us were there, right? And so, you know, do we really have a chance? Lay it out.
Well, first of all, the God of Gods has returned from Canada, David L. Cohen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For people who don't know him, while he was in his Canadian slumber or whatever he was doing as ambassador up there, he's the man who makes things happen in the city. He used to be the number, three in command of Comcast. He was Ed Rendell's deputy.
Yeah, mayor.
I mean, everybody knows that he was the
right-hand man.
He was chief of staff.
Yeah.
He was the man who did everything, and Ed went out and cut the ribbons and kissed the babies. And even Ed would admit that David was the person who got a lot of stuff done. And
he's now back in this.
He's now the leader of this effort.
Yeah.
Okay. He told me on Thursday that Philadelphia has a fantastic chance, if not 28, then 32, because they're looking forward to do two convention bookings in a row. So Philadelphia might not get 28, but they could get 32 and be named now for 32.
Wow. Want to read in a few comments here. Frank says, Philly spends $19 million on two-day-a-week trash pickup. That benefits people who produce a lot of waste. It's not a lot of money in the big picture, but could help the schools a bit. So that's one of Frank's topics du jour.
That's not going to change. That's the mayor's pet project. That is not going to change.
He likes a clean green.
Dandelion Greens on YouTube says, I was seriously bothered by Stanford not attending the WHYY debate. I was going to use that debate to decide my vote, and it did, but not like I expected.
Wow.
Interesting. Matt comments on city council, pandering is alive and well among Philly politicians. I think Matt's referring to our conversation about the schools earlier. Let's get a caller in. This is David from Center City. Hey, David, you're on Studio 2. What Philly news topic do you want to discuss?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm calling about the third congressional district race that you were just talking about. And pretty much the point I wanted to make was a comment that I think the main difference between these candidates that is one of the biggest wedge issues that's going to decide this election and decide, you know, for the electorate who they support is the issue of money and dark money and AIPAC money in general. Because I think Chris Rabb has made a very strong stance about that. And I think that's where the momentum in the Democratic electorate is going.
Yeah. Thank you. That's David from Center City. Anna, you want to comment on that or Tom?
Yeah. He's absolutely right that Chris Rabb has made this a big point. Rab's point is that, you know, he's branded A Law Stanford as benefiting from AIPAC money. So that's the pro-Israel lobby. We don't have much evidence yet that that's true. But given the super PAC that's backing her takes, as Tom said, what's called dark money, they're not required to disclose all of their donors to the federal government. So we don't actually know.
Yeah, and it's like her response to it. I don't know how effective you think that has been, Tom.
Well, there's been a progressive wave throughout the country right now and in Philadelphia. I mean, the council members that are fighting the school closures are all the progressives. So when you look at it, progressive is making a big push throughout the city. Maybe Rab comes out from around just like the Kentucky Derby and wins it in the end by a head.
We'll see. By the way, got to talk about this new Philadelphia bus terminal, new old one, because it's back to where it used to be.
It is more than what it used to be. It is gorgeous.
I went in there over the weekend. It looks so nice when you compare it to having to sit on the curb on Spring Garden Street, Tom.
Well, so where is it, first of all? We've got to remind folks
it's
the whole saga here.
It's the same place, yes. Filbert Street.
Near to Chinatown, essentially, yeah.
Near Chinatown, but there's a change. And if people don't know this, you can drive down Market Street and make a left-hand turn now between City Hall and Independence National Memorial Park. I mean, Historical Park. And that's a big thing because it keeps the buses out of Chinatown, which was the way the Chinatown Development Corporation signed off. The bus terminal is the old Greyhound terminal that was giving shabby a bad name. And it is beautiful now, clean bathrooms, everything is
vending
spectacular.
Machines, it's very nice.
Right, but it's
and they're going to put a cafe.
Right? It's only temporary, right?
It could be up to 15 years.
Could be up to 15 years. Because, but the long-term plan is what here?
Long-term plan is to find a permanent location, hopefully out by 30th Street Station.
Because they wanted an inner-city bus terminal.
Connected to rail, connected to everything, so you could basically go just about anywhere.
Wow.
All right, so we're getting close to the end of the hour here, and we wanted each of you to talk about a story, maybe a little under the radar that's got your eye. Kristen Graham earlier recommended a great story by Alex Coffey at the Inquirer about this attorney who helped structure the new collective bargaining agreement in the WNBA and happens to be a labor attorney here in Philadelphia. Who knew? Anna Orso, give us your story. It's got to be as good as that one, so there's a lot of pressure here.
There is a lot of pressure. I think my story is really good. So my colleague Dugan Arnett wrote a story a few weeks ago about a pit bull named 40.
Okay.
He's from Frankfurt. He went missing 10 years ago.
I think I
ran
heard about
away
this
from
one.
Home.
Yeah.
His parents moved to Luzerne County. They got a call from the SPCA, a couple weeks ago. We have 40.
Oh my
40
God.
40
found after 10 years. They came and picked him up, and now he's
This is
home
a
again.
Hollywood movie.
Wow.
How did they find him? Like, what was the...
He was turned in.
He had a chip.
But it had to be his chip.
He had a chip. He came into ACCT.
Did they know where this dog was?
They didn't know where he was until he came in to ACCT.
Go ahead now.
What was that movie? It was called Homeward Bound. Does anyone remember that movie? That's like about this kind of thing. These dogs get lost for a long, long time and they somehow find their way home.
Yes.
I think this should be the sequel to that. This sounds amazing.
Amazing.
Not just the movie. And Tom, I know you got a great story. What's your story?
Mine is the development at the sports complex.
Mm.
We're going to build a new arena out there, which we've known is going to be in the old location of the Spectrum, but that's going to delay redevelopment to make it more like the Battery in Atlanta.
Right.
They want to put in high-rise.
They want to make it a whole neighborhood.
Right. They want to make it a neighborhood with more entertainment and make it a 365-day-a-year happening location. That's going to be interesting to see, A, if it can be built, B, if the zoning happens, and C, if there's any city money involved.
I feel like that's been an idea forever.
Floating
around.
Take that part of sort of like
yeah, but far remember South who Philadelphia, is, remember the Navy who Yard. Remember who is part of the Sixers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've got people who are developers that are part of the Sixers.
Sure.
Comcast wants to maximize their return on investment.
They own the Flyers.
Right.
And so you're saying there's the money and the power this time to make it happen?
Yes, absolutely.
And what's the time? You said the timeline for that is then after they build this.
Well, it's going to be after 2030 because we've got to get the new arena up by 2030 for the WNBA team that's coming to town.
And meanwhile,
I cannot wait for it. You know, I get very excited every time we mention the WNBA.
And meanwhile, there's still, I feel like, forever plans to try to turn the Navy Yard into some sort of neighborhood. And there's now some development down.
Well,
so
you know,
there's a hotel
there now, and there's more building constantly, and it makes for a whole package if you start building up the Navy Yard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this hour and for being such great guests. And
we covered
for tackling
a lot today.
So many different topics. Tom McDonald is a reporter at WHYY. Tom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having
studio
me.
Studio too. And Anna Orso, covers City Hall for the Philadelphia Inquirer, told us about everything, including, what was the dog's name again, Anna?
40.
40.
40. Thank you for spending 40 plus minutes with us, Anna Orso. We were so appreciated on Studio 2.
Thank you, friends.
Yeah, 40 found after 10 years. That is an unforgettable story. And thank you for our caller and for everybody who wrote in with your stories that you are following here in Philadelphia. And of course, we couldn't do any of what we do without our producers. I got to say thank you to Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, Paige Murray Bessler, Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us. And guess what? We have the great privilege of talking to you tomorrow.